everyone, and thank you for joining Metacode Talks, our live series of conversations with the people shaping and making the future of digital assets. I'm very happy to welcome Alex Lipton today. Alex and I have been working together and know each other for more than 4 years today. We started teaching together at a university class at the Swiss Technology University, EPFL, on the field of blockchain and distributed ledgers. Since then, we have found many opportunities to collaborate. And obviously, Alex did not wait for me to work on many other related topics, whether on financial technologies, banking, physics, and all of these fancy topics that he loves so much and that I hope we have the opportunity to discuss today. Alex, your curriculum vitae is so long and deep that I don't have the, I would say, ambition to cover it exhaustively today. But I will just mention that you are today a chief information officer at Sila Money, which is very closely related to stablecoin. And I think this is going to be one of the topics we cover today. You are also a collection science fellow at MIT and a visiting professor and dean's fellow at HUJI. But you know, it's not just about academia and industry. You also are now an entrepreneur with strong ties to multiple companies in fintech and outside of fintech. Zilliqa and Clearmatics are just two examples. I know you're also an advisor to Swiss bank Signum. So, you know, what unites us today in this conversation is the fact that we are obviously very happy to announce this book that we have worked on and co-authored on blockchain and distributed ledgers, which is called Blockchain and Distributed Ledgers, Mathematics, Technology, and Economics. And it's now out and ready for pre-buy, pre-sale. I would like to discuss this topic with you. Thank you very much for being here today. And please feel free to jump in now and tell me a few words about your backgrounds and how you got involved into cryptocurrencies, into distributed ledger technology. Was it a natural step for you after your experience in banking, in particular at Bank of America, or was it something that you ended up doing by chance or, you know, out of curiosity?
Thank you very much, Adrian. Indeed, it's a pleasure to be with you today. And as you said, to sort of present a little bit our forthcoming book, which took us so long to write, but I hope the final product is of interest to the general public. And to answer your question, you know, as you said, my background is varied and I did many different things in my life, stretching from thermonuclear fusion to astrophysics and from fluid dynamics to, you know, to some other topics which I'm not at liberty to discuss. But eventually I gravitated towards banking and worked at all kind of leading investment banks of the world, starting with the fabled Bankers Trust. I also worked a little bit at a famous hedge fund called Citadel here in Chicago, where I am now. And then when I moved to London to run the Quant Organization for Bank of America, I became interested. That was early 2000s, that 2010s, that sort of thing, sort of in 2013, 2014, I became very interested in blockchain and Bitcoin and things like that. And then my company, Bank of America, moved me to New York to be quantitative solutions executive for the firm as a whole. And part of my remit was technical aspects of blockchains and investments in all kind of ecosystem of growing companies. You know, Metaco would be a prime example if it were to exist at that time, but I think you founded it a year or two later. But anyway, so I looked at it and I was fascinated. I will be honest with you, my first inclination was more towards application of blockchain than cryptocurrencies themselves. And I was somewhat skeptical for a little while, which I no longer am. I'm still not a wide enthusiast and zealot, but I certainly do see much more what people were telling me then, which I didn't see. And I also feel that we are at a cusp. Right now, honestly, we're at a cusp which will move the system from the state in which it has been for a few hundred years into something new. What it's going to be and how it's going to operate and all that remains to be seen, but we certainly live in a very, very interesting time. So I'll
well, can you actually say a few words? You say that the system has been in some form over the last few hundred years. What was it before? I know you're expert in understanding how money and financial interactions have evolved through time. Can you say a bit more about how this evolution is so special and potentially how it relates to previous evolutions which have already occurred naturally?
Okay, it's an excellent question, and it's something which I'm very keen on talking and writing about. And we cover it a little bit in the book as well, naturally. But the point which I want to make that money has existed through human history, and in fact, progress in money transmission and transactions is actually one of the underlying foundational blocks of the progress of the society as a whole. And interestingly enough, in the ancient Sumer and in Mesopotamia, the progress was made, which was then forgotten for millennia, literally, sort of money as records were known 2,000 or 3,000 years before the Common Era, and then, more or less thoroughly forgotten for a couple of thousand of years, and money was predominantly in the form of objects. But then, it became clear that it is not really commensurable with requirements of the, ever more complex growing economic system. And so money as records became prevalent again. And, it initially occurred in the form of sort of modern banking in Venice and Genoa in Italy, and then spread through Lyon, all the way kind of through Swiss borders, all the way up north to the Low Countries, and from the Low Countries after the, 80 years war between the Netherlands, which didn't exist. They occurred as a result of the war, but Spain, and then it spread around to London, Paris, Zurich, and other, Lausanne, Geneva, and etc. to other centers. So the idea became that there is a person and the money, and there is an organization which handles this money. So essentially, what we observe, without sort of being without any prejudice or anything, it's a system aligned with the organization of the Catholic Church, so to speak, right? So you cannot read the Bible yourself, right? And a priest has to interpret the Bible for you because it's written in Latin and not that many people knew Latin, right? So of course, educated classes did to a degree, but many others didn't. And so there is a concept and interpreter, same with money. So you don't really, unless you do a cash payment, you have to rely to a banker to do payment for you, right? And so essentially, if you and I want to exchange some value, it wouldn't be directly between you and I, but it would be between me and my banker, then your banker, and then you, right? And this is the simplest possible connection.
I mean, so the current system is based on the Catholics kind of methodology.
If you wish. Again, I don't want to go into this aspect, but what I try to say is that maybe a better analogy would be, like people using manuscripts to disseminate the ideas. And then comes the printing press, right? So, and it fills the gap, a knowledge gap, which existed, and the 15th century things changed dramatically. And one of the consequences of that was this, the Reformation, right? So Reformation and a Protestant streak where you are no longer relying on priests to interpret the Bible. You can read it in vernacular and understand what it means. Now, I view this cryptocurrencies potentially as something along similar lines. So essentially, in the ideal world, the way it was envisioned by Satoshi Nakamoto, not the world which actually materialized as of now, but I still have high hopes, but in the ideal world, I should just have some Bitcoin, and if I need to send you a certain modicum of value, I just send it from my address to your address and we're done. So essentially there are no more bankers in between, provided that we're consenting adults and we do know how to handle our security key, private keys, secret keys, and that, et cetera, which is by no means a trivial trait, be it at the individual level or even more so at the level of an organization. And again, in the book, we do cover this topic of key security, which is in fact of paramount importance for the success of the whole thing. Right, so this is the ideal picture. What we see right now is that direct usage of the money is not still quite possible. And in reality, for an ordinary person to get a Bitcoin, they have to become a sort of a member of a centralized organization, an exchange, right? So be it a Coinbase, a Kraken, as many, you know, myriad of others. That is an issue, to be perfectly honest, right? So that is something to think about and to work towards the ability of actually earning Bitcoins or other cryptocurrencies in a decentralized fashion and spending them in decentralized fashion. That has not been resolved. Yet, the underlying layer, which allows you in principle to do this, is there.
That's super interesting. And would you say, because you pointed out that exchanges are still very centralized, but we see protocols now appearing in the market facilitating peer-to-peer trading, and obviously this works in conjunction with stable coins. I know you are very familiar with stable coins. Do you see a future where, you know, we don't have to go through Coinbase, speaking of the massive success of this week, we don't have to go through Coinbase, potentially we can directly access some form of value and distributed currency through peer-to-peer internet exchanges?
That is what I would very much like to see, because that would be the actual implementation of this Satoshi sort of dream, if you wish, right? So the way it is, it always reminds me of a malaphorism from a former Russian Prime Minister Chernomyrdin, who was, you know, a man of the people and, you know, like a simple rustic individual. So he liked to say, we wanted to do it as best as we could, and it turned out to be as usual. So that's in a sense what we observe right now, right? So to get a Bitcoin, you have to do it in a centralized fashion, unless in fairness, you start selling some of your services for Bitcoins. Then it is in principle possible to start doing things.
Or if you mind. Potentially,
yes, exactly. You're absolutely right. The reason why I said the selling services for Bitcoin, I'm thinking in terms of an individual, because mining now is also, in fact, highly centralized, right? So it's not as it used to be, right? So it's, you know, in Russia, they have this strange saying, so you should mine while you're young, right? So something like that, right? So, but it's too late right now to view mining as a real possibility of sort of doing it in decentralized investments and mining rigs. Very, very substantial, right? And if you really sort of do it as an individual, you know, having a few mining rigs in your garage, then of course you might probably get something out of it, but it's so infrequent and so, you know, unpredictable that people much prefer to join into gigantic mining pools, of which, of course, the heart is in China, but there are many others, right? So, but Chinese mining pools are particularly big, right? So, anyway, so my take on it is that we absolutely should develop further decentralized finance. It's the most exciting, you know, things happening right now. And if and when it reaches sort of maturity, we will see fantastic things, I think.
And Alex, you know, you've been in banking. I tend to believe, and sometimes I clash with bankers on this topic, that banks started as being essentially vaults. You know, in the center of the village, you had this place with a highly secure a vault securing different kinds of assets. And then banks started adding different value-added services, loans, lending, and things like this. Do you think that it is possible that with the advance of DeFi, banks actually have to get back to being simple vaults because everything else becomes decentralized?
This is a super interesting question. You know, I struggle with it myself and have been writing about it. Well, we wrote about it in the book, and also, you know, I have been writing before and after, and sort of in a few weeks' time, I hope, you know, an opinion piece which I wrote at the invitation of Barron's, a business newspaper in the US, will appear, where I discuss that very issue. But the answer to your question is, I envision separation of the entire banking industry into narrow banks, and I will explain in a moment what it is, and investment pools. So narrow bank is a bank which essentially, as you say, is just a vault. And of course, for somebody like, you know, CEO of Metaco, which actually is a really interesting company, you know, the meaning of the vault has changed compared to what it was. Even though, you know, make no mistake, you know, people still keep vaults for their valuables. And in fact, I just heard about a project by some people in New York who want to have a stable coin anchored in gold. And according to the prospectus, they secured $6 billion worth of gold bars, which they plan to store somewhere in Switzerland, of course. And so that is one type of vault. The other type of vault is electronic vault. So the narrow bank is a bank which cannot fail due to market forces, but potentially can fail because of technological failures and vault not being strong enough. That certainly is a struggle between the robbers and cops, right? So like people who try to break electronic security and the people who try to protect it. And in my mind, the pure cryptographically oriented security is necessary, absolutely, but it has to be strengthened with hardware, which is also hardened. So essentially, narrow bank is just a bank with sole assets in fiat bank, so electronic money held at the central bank, and similar sort of, depending on the definition and the broadness of your vision, similar financial instruments, like very short dated bonds and stuff like that. So that's one thing. The other thing is credit creation. Right now, the two are commingled, which in fact, in my mind, is a major, major affliction of the banking system. I think the bank, when people are talking about banks, they are talking about banks as too big to fail. That is certainly an issue, definitely, especially in countries like the United States or Switzerland, for that matter, right? So where two of your banks dominate the landscape, and then one of them actually had its fair share of blinders, shall we say, right? So to be polite to my host, I'm not gonna go any further. I'll leave it at that, but I'm sure everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? So, but the problem is not so much that they're too big to fail, they're too big to manage and too big to regulate. These are the aspects which I would like to emphasize. And the reason why is that they violate the division of labor maxim, which was articulated by the French encyclopedists and also by Adam Smith and everything else. So when he was describing the spin factory, somebody on the pulls the wire, somebody else cuts the wire, somebody else sharpened the pin, etc., etc., etc. And this is why they were able to produce such marvelous things at very low prices, because everybody does. Banks commingle, keeping records and making loans. And in effect, if you think about it, do you really want to be a customer at a bank where sort of you have your money? And again, I will explain what I really mean by money, because if you think that you have money in the bank, you're actually mistaken. At least in the Anglo-Saxon law, you're just a junior unsecured creditor. So it's not like you really have the money if something were to happen, God forbids. But I mean, and then banks does loans for which you're not being compensated at all. So this really is not the right business model anymore. It might have been when interest rates were capped at the natural level. And by natural level, again, reasonable people can disagree, but I would say 3 to 5% is where we need to aim at interest rate. And this is not what we see at all, right? So in America, it's hovering around zero. In Switzerland, it's negative. And Denmark, it's negative. In Europe, I'm not 100% sure, but it's probably negative to zero, that sort of thing. So this is, there is no longer compensation. And so the fair thing to do is to separate. So banks keep records. If you are feeling that, you know, that the blockchain is not good enough for you, or you are not good enough for blockchain in the sense that it's too hard to actually, you know, maintain all the keys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there are investment pools. And that's sort of investment pool, you put your money in, then it's being loaned. And the fractional reserve model will switch to something else. It will just change the velocity of money, so to speak. Because, you know, if I were to lend you, for example, a pen, right? So the way it works is that I have a pen now, I give it to you, I don't have a pen anymore. With money, it's not like that. When a bank lends you money, it's not like it has money somewhere which it gives to you. It creates money out of thin air. Right now, this tendency actually is a little slowed, more by for lack of demand and lack of will, if you wish, from the commercial banks, and by the principle of substitution, by the fact that central bank became a fractional reserve bank, at least, you know, in America, and to some degree in Switzerland, where the national Swiss National Bank actively purchases at least, you know, foreign currencies, if not nothing else, right? So in America, you know, the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve grew by a factor of 10 over that many years, right? So over 12 years. Right now it's about 7 trillion and it used to be 700-800 billion before the financial crisis of 2008. So we see a complete separation and changes, and you know, the banking industry is not in the state of equilibrium right now. Let me put it this way.
I mean, has it ever been? I mean, let me ask you a question. When Bitcoin was launched in 2008, Satoshi included this famous sentence in the first block that obviously is critical of the way money is managed today, the way banks have been saved by the taxpayers. Do you see this as being saved by the central banks today? Do you think we are improving? Or do you think that potentially the situation has worsened and we may be facing what Satoshi kind of predicted, which is, I wouldn't say collapse, but at least a significant degradation of the economic environment, which may lead to alternative assets becoming dominant, such as cryptocurrencies, where the supply is algorithmically capped?
That is a very interesting question. You know, like algorithmically capped supply for money per se might not necessarily be such a great idea, because it's tantamount to central planning. And you have not mentioned that when you were describing my life trajectory, but I was born and bred in Moscow, Russia, Soviet Union. I left, you know, a long time ago, but I still remember results of central planning, which were far from being perfect, right? So, you know, I would say, you know, an asset which has algorithmic supply, or in fact fixed supply, I would say has a great advantage potentially as a store of value, whether it is significant advantages as a medium of exchange remains to be seen, because, you know, like in a sense, what we see, if we were to measure everything in Bitcoin, an enormous deflation of assets, right? So, and if you think about it, right, so if you're lucky enough to have a Bitcoin, would you really, and you want to go on vacation, would you really sort of cough, I don't know, 1/10 of a Bitcoin, or, you know, 20% of your Bitcoin, to go somewhere nice, but then, you know, you paid, and then, you know, in 6 months' time, of course, it's now like you paid, twice as much, that sort of thing. That stops people from using it for this purpose, right? And then, you know, this
proverbial... Sorry to interrupt. Is it bad though? You know, this is always a debate between multiple schools in economics, and some would argue that you need an inflationary currency to encourage consumption, but others would say, well, having a deflationary asset actually encourages people to save, which potentially is a much better equilibrium. Even though people may buy less iPhones per year or less consumables, potentially that's actually something which is healthier. What do you think?
That is possible. In fact, definitely with the current inflationary model, as it is implemented by central banks throughout the world, there is a substantial hollowing of the middle class for a simple reason that there are no more vehicles for saving, right? So John Maynard Keynes pointed out that money is the only link between the past and the future. And it was sort of traditional that you work for, say, 40 years, and then you enjoy your retirement, and you can, your money works for you when you kind of enjoy your life, right? So this is no longer the case in the traditional economies, right? So if you saved $1 million, say 30, 40 years ago, you could live on the interest for the rest of your life, maybe not a luxurious life, but certainly decent, very decent life. Now, of course, it gives you nothing, right? So the bank for $1 million, first of all, it might not even want your deposit of $1 million, but if it does, sort of instead of interest, you would receive a coffee maker if your bank is generous, and a toaster if it's not. So you see what I'm saying? So that's certainly a possibility of thinking of highly deflationary, environment as advantageous to savers. I would say very sharp appreciation of the main medium of exchange probably is bad, because, you know, it all has to grow and shrink with the economy itself, right? So if, for example, well, Bitcoin, for example, grew by a factor of at least 5 over, you know, and in fact, more than that, like maybe, I'm sorry, maybe even 10, sort of, it depends, you know, with Bitcoin, it all always depends when you take the starting point and, you know, current. So, but I mean, say 5-10 times over this period of 1 year, right? So this is sort of for economic sort of activity, it seems to be a little too brisk, right? So I would prefer from that perspective to see an appreciation of, say, 10-15%, that sort of thing. You see what I'm saying? If one were to think about it seriously from a pure economic perspective.
Could we say, Alex, that in the past, the central bank currencies, the national currencies, have been protected to some degree by the fact that they were the only ones to be really liquid, in the sense you could use them to buy a piece of bread, to buy anything, anywhere, essentially. But now this equilibrium is changing, because Bitcoin or some cryptocurrencies are becoming extremely liquid. You can use them in more and more shops. Sometimes it can be converted on the fly to national currencies. So would it be fair to say that in such an environment, even if potentially some economists would argue that national currencies with a little bit of inflation is better than a deflationary Bitcoin, that ultimately, because both are now liquid, the market will decide, and savers will ultimately decide if they prefer storing 95% of their assets in Bitcoin and potentially just moving into the inflationary currency last minute when they are forced to do so?
That is entirely possible. So you see, there is a very big nuance which we need to appreciate, right? So which is that if Bitcoin were to become a medium of exchange on par with fiat currencies, an interesting phenomenon will occur. That is, there would be initially a huge inflation. And think about it in very simple terms, right? So if Bitcoin is used as a store of value, that's fine, because you know, Bitcoin is sort of always bought and sold or mined, but mining right now is already, I would say secondary in importance, because right now they mine about 1,000 Bitcoins a day, right? So given that there is already 18 million Bitcoins, it's not a lot. And then, it will be decreasing with a predicted schedule of halving and that sort of thing. But, if it's used as store of value, that's fine. So you paid your 50,000 and received a Bitcoin, and somebody sold it to you and received 50,000. So for buying goods, there is only 50,000 right now, because Bitcoin sort of sucked it out of the system as being used as storage, right? Now imagine that more and more you can actually buy Bitcoin. So now, and willing to use it. Say, for example, to buy a Tesla, right? So I don't anticipate Bitcoin being used to pay for coffee and that sort of thing anytime soon or ever, because it's not designed along these lines. I would say that other currencies can certainly be used, be it stable coins or be it something else, but Bitcoin probably. But for bigger pieces like a car, right? So which cost $80,000, maybe $100,000, so maybe 1-2 Bitcoins, you do it, right? So then there are two ways of paying for the same goods, right? Bitcoin and the dollars. And so essentially, the twice as many, tokens, of value are chasing the same goods. So that creates a big inflation, right? So that was a major problem with Libra, for example, right? So Libra, or Diem, as it's called right now, they were saying that it will help, underdeveloped countries and, emerging economies, et cetera, et cetera. The truth of the matter is that it would actually create enormous inflation, because attracting, say, for example, to use an example of Switzerland, it's like attracting euros becoming also, on par with Swiss franc, not just marginally being used here and there and then border areas or ski resorts, but really if it were to become, then there would be too much, so to speak, right? So that is something to think about, right? So I would prefer for the time being to see Bitcoin as a store of value more than a medium of exchange. That is sort of, and I think it's in a sense what we really see, right? As I said, it's also quite interesting, right? That, some people think that Bitcoin can be used, for example, in the corporate treasury, and we know some examples, right? Some others don't. And it's very interesting that the number of Bitcoins, which, for example, the fabled, the mighty Coinbase has, it's, much less than one would expect, right? So they only have, 4,000 or 5,000 Bitcoins. It's not a lot, if you know what I mean, right? So it's a complicated, it's a complicated struggle between prudence on one sense and enthusiasm on the other thing. And it's all very interesting to see and to participate a little bit, right?
So Alex, well, what would you say then is the right payment protocol? So Bitcoin may become a more efficient payment protocol, for instance, with layer two, more scalable, less expensive transactions. But one can still argue that it has some properties which make it great for savings, but less great for payments. We have seen out there many initiatives for stable coins. Some of them are algorithmic, some of them rely on the distributed oracle. You are obviously very close to your own initiative, Silamani. How does it aim to solve these considerations? How is it actually potentially avoiding this inflationary crisis that you're pointing out?
This is a very interesting question, and thank you for asking, and it gives me an opportunity to plug a little bit silamoney.com, which I don't want to, you know, spend too much time. You know, people can go to the website and see for themselves. But what we're trying to do, we're trying to merge, you know, the cryptos, you know, stable coin and stuff with a real economy demands for payments for startups, and in particular for fintech startups or any other startups who need regulated payments. Because make no mistake, as you were saying, you know, the various mechanisms states protect the fiat and the advantageous position and the sort of, you know, in the food chain by being the sole issuers of fiat and stuff like that. One of the very important ones is that you have to do KYC, know your client, and anti-money laundering. And that's something which is baked in our SILA protocol and general offering from the very beginning. And that is very important. I think that, you know, putting aside discussion which we had, you know, earlier, like that, you know, there is a burning desire to be able to transact on the internet the same way as people transact in ordinary cash. You know, like what we're trying to do is to make it all regulatory compliant to the best of our ability, right? So that is what we feel differentiates us from others, and also the aim is to really use it in real economy as opposite to many stable coins like Tether, for example, and others, which are predominantly oriented towards exchanges, right? So, you know, like there is an old saying, right? So if a man needs some wood, he will grow a forest, right? So, you know, that's what exchanges really could not rely on banking services to allow getting in and out of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum. And because of that, they had to invent stable coins, right? So because then you can have a closed ecosystem, which is being ingressed or egressed only infrequently, and everything else is happening at a decent time scale. Because otherwise, if you were to use bank transfers and so on to sell your Bitcoin, get your money, then go back, et cetera, it would not be workable. So, but our heart desire is to cover some of it as well, if possible, but mostly we want to squarely direct our activities on real economy, you know, sort of people really do payments and that sort of thing. So that's how I would describe it, right?
Understood. And Alex, you know, the DeFi, decentralized finance, has obviously grown substantially over the last few years. I find it interesting to see how issues that we faced with stablecoins in the past were some of the initiatives that date way before Bitcoin was invented, where, you know, a company would just have a bit of gold in a vault and then would create some form of a digital accounting system to transact. Well, they all faced the same weakness, which was that they were so centralized that the government would end up knocking at the door and saying, well, you're favoring money laundering and facilitating illegal activities, so we're going to take your gold and shut you down. And so to this, you can have two reactions, in my opinion. One is to do exactly what you're doing, which is to say, we're going to start from scratch, being fully compliant and actually supporting the current regulations. And then there is another way, which is what DeFi has engaged with, which is to say, we're going to try to avoid having a collateral whatsoever. We're going to have actually a stable coin, which is based on inputs coming from oracles that define the exchange rates. And yes, there is a collateral, but this collateral is not something in the real world. It's something like Ether or some form of a decentralized token. Do you think that, first of all, this is a sustainable system in the context where you've lived through the 2008 crisis? You were actually in banking at this period. You've seen how CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, have been one of the weak points of the crisis. Do you feel that what is now a sort of a digital CDO on-chain, do you think this is something that's sustainable, or are we in the early days of a massive collapse?
It's a brilliant question, Adrian, and indeed I could not help but notice that indeed I was in charge of modeling a lot of this collateral obligations, and I was vehemently opposed, in fact, to this the main copula model, which subsequently was blamed for that. It's actually
the Georgian one, right?
There were too many other problems, but you know, it's a matter of fact that in 2006, Andrew Rennie and I held a conference at Merrill Lynch and published a book. I'm not advertising, it's no longer that interesting, but it's a proof that some people, myself included, saw that coming, because the book is called The Credit Derivatives, The Life After Copulas. And that was done right at the height of the copula craze. But anyway, so as you say, one of the things which were characteristic to that was pooling resources, something which we also see in decentralized finance, and then slicing them into tranches where the lower tranches would absorb losses, protecting the higher tranches from defaults. And then, of course, the cash flows coming to the pool as a whole would be distributed appropriately, right? So, and there might have been small mispricing of this cash flows coming from the topmost tranches, and that was supposed to be a great idea of getting something out of nothing. And for example, that was the undoing of AIG, right? Fabled, insurance company, right? So which was founded in China, 100 plus years ago, and then became dominant. And so what they were doing, they were saying, okay, for a good measure, we'll sell you an insurance to this topmost tranches because they will never be affected. And so it's free money for us. That's not how it turned out to be. And it is entirely possible that something like that might have happened with decentralized finance as well. So make no mistake, this a lot depends on perception of the investors as much on the reality. Even many of those AAA rated tranches which blew up, in reality, they didn't blow up, right? So they eventually kind of, if held to maturity, they paid everything they promised and so on and so forth. But they had to be liquidated by banks in the interim because people thought that they have lost all their value. So it's a very nuanced question, which relates to a large degree to what extent the price of the underlying, which is used as a collateral to create something stable, actually behaves in a reasonable way. The fact that financial prices are stochastic is understood by all. The fact that they are unpredictable and non-stationary, understood by much fewer people. And the fact that they can have tremendous jumps, appreciated by even fewer number of people. And that is something which can be the undoing of this super senior tranches, and in particular, which I used, as you say, to dynamically collateralize stable tranches in, Dow Maker and stuff like that. So, the problem also, the other problem is that in the best of time, when everything is quiet and so on, this thing operates in the order reverse to how the conventional finance operates, right? So because in finance, they allow people to make purchases on margins, and we have seen, something like that happening with our Argegos, right? So they were allowed to purchase, maybe, I don't know exactly, but say 100 billion for the sake of the argument worth of various stocks, then some of the banks managed to liquidate them and some others have not, right? So, and those who managed to liquidate, they didn't lose, I mean, they did not cover themselves in glory, but they didn't lose any money. And others not only didn't cover themselves in glory, but also lose $5 billion here, $2 billion there. You see, that is the danger, right? So that's the danger, that if the underlying starts to jump down very quickly, there might not be enough time to liquidate, right? So, but nevertheless, I would say that it's a very interesting, that's a very interesting development we see, right? So decentralized finance is really something new. Say what you want, but you know, Bitcoin is something new. Ethereum is definitely something new, but it might actually be too new for its own good, right? So because I view Ethereum as a consensus as a service provider, and that's what we write about in the book. But there is a problem when it becomes too expensive, the services also become too expensive, right? And it becomes very hard to use it. And the same story with decentralized finance, right? So when you start using it in earnest, it becomes too expensive. You have to pay so much for gas that small players cannot really do this. It's only if you like do 100,000 or whatever, 10,000 transaction, you say, okay, I'll pay 200 in fees, right? So if you want to do 500, you know, and pay 200 in fees, it's kind of a much less attractive proposition. Still, from a conceptual perspective, it is very, very interesting, all I can say, yeah. And we cover it in the book a little bit. We talk about, you know, automated market makers, and that is really an attractive idea, right? So it's, you know, the only thing to bear in mind is that when they talk about the impermanent loss, it's actually, you know, a figure of speech, you know, this impermanent loss, if market, you know, if the underlying exchange rate is mean reverting, then of course this loss is impermanent. However, if something happens and it, you know, moves one way or the other, then it can very easily become permanent. Still, as I said, conceptually, it's something new, right? So it's nice to live in this time and see new things developing all the time. Hmm?
In times of this massive growth of NFTs, non-fungible tokens, are you, Alex, the proud owner of a crypto kitty or a different kind of picture that is more to your taste?
No, to be perfectly honest, I'm not. And, you know, and I was never able to understand the attraction of the modern art, you know, like, I just couldn't, you know, it's me. It's not the art, I suppose. And similar with NFTs, but at least from a conceptual standpoint, NFTs is a sort of electronic version of a print, for example, right? So like some artists have been known to create enormous number of prints of their work, and Dali is the prime example. And as we all know, you know, the idea of a signed print is that it's supposed that the artist look at it against the sharp light to see if there are no imperfections, and then only sign it if it meets his or her exacting standards, right? So, and if it's bad, then it's destroyed. As we all know, Dali were signing, you know, blank sheets of paper, and then, you know, the you know, prints were created afterwards. But nevertheless, the idea is that you have something which actually many other people have as well, but yours is signed. And then there is a value in a signed one compared to the aesthetic value. I mean, aesthetic value is probably the same, right? So if you put in your living room a Dali print, which is signed, versus a print which is produced by the same, you know, publisher, which is unsigned, you know, the difference is de minimis. But in the sales price, et cetera, and the price of ownership, and whatnot, you know, this is very, very different. And same with NFT. So the way I think about NFT is like this. I'll show you. So imagine that this is a baseball, right? So, and then, you know, baseballs are what, $10 a piece or something like that. And that's what they go for. But if somebody great signs it for you and they, you know, it happens when you caught this, you know, on the stands and everybody saw it, et cetera, and it's on tape and everything, then it becomes suddenly, say, 100 times or 1,000 times more expensive. Right. Same with, you know, this NFTs. Right. So you can have an electronic file. Right. So you can download, you know, so, for example, this, you know, like 5,000 days. Right. So this, you know, Uber by Beeple. Right. And you'll have it probably. I'm not sure if you're really able to really have it in super fine resolution. That I just don't know. But suppose. But then, you know, the one which he signed, it's a very different one. So that's how I think about it. So the idea is old. The implementation definitely is completely new. Definitely. The medium which is being used, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How sustainable it is remains to be seen. In my mind, there are still some gaps. And again, the same way as I was saying that with security, you cannot just go for cryptography, but you have to go for a combination. Same with there. So I don't really know what has to be done, but something along these lines, right? So, but one thing which is good is that, you know, if this is a, you know, a baseball and it is signed and I gave it to you and then you gave it to Jessica, et cetera, et cetera. Now it's all recorded on blockchain. And so the provenance is very easy to prove, right? So because as we all know, the vast majority of paintings and the leading museums of the world, and I don't know, don't want to name them because I don't want any legal trouble, but a leading museum in the world, I'm sure that 50% of all paintings are fake, you know, and they themselves know it as well, right? And then the provenance is also very, very hard to establish. And of course, there were, you know, like all these events, you know, during the war when, you know, the chains of ownership was brutally broken and so on and so on. With this, at least, you know, like if there are legitimate transfers of from one party to the other, they all recorded. And so from the origin of this digital masterpiece to its current ownership, you can trace it all. And at least, you know, you can sleep well by knowing that you have a signed copy of a particular file rather than anyone else. Hmm?
And it's a philosophical point, but does it mean that one can create value out of thin air? You know, but, you know, we used to be able to use these pictures online, that they would be free of rights for most of them, and they would have almost zero value. And suddenly, just creating some proof of origin has created millions, if not billions, of value out there, which did not exist. So let me push this to the extreme. Does it mean that if the world, you know, if everybody in this world starts tokenizing everything, you know, your right arm, your left arm, your desk, your car, your keys, does it mean that you end up actually creating wealth, or is there some kind of a mental bug here?
I don't think so. I mean, everything is good in moderation, right? So Bitcoin created this, you know, moment when the Bible was translated from Latin to vernacular. Unfortunately, immediately there is a crowd of people which sort of separate you from your Bitcoin, right? So, well, in fact, even MetaCode to some degree, right, by providing services which in principle self-sovereign people should be able to do themselves, but in practice, of course, they can't just because it's too complicated, right? So it's not so easy to be, you know, your own keeper of value and so on and so forth. Make no mistake, you know, banks as vaults do play an important role because there is a recourse. There are many things to say about, you know, like a trusted keeper of value and so on. I think that with NFTs, time will tell to what extent it will, you know, stand, because, you know, as they say, in principle, you can sell, you know, anything, right? So provided that somebody buys it, right? So what it really shows, without any shadow of the doubt, that existing macroeconomic theory are not even wrong, they just totally barking at a completely wrong tree. And, you know, this idea that markets are efficient and so on, it's just ludicrous. And, you know, these are proofs. If any more proofs are needed, the fact that you can sell something which had zero value before, as you had, by a simple act of saying, you know, now you are the owner of a copy which can be traced from the origin, creates 60 million or whatnot. No, that doesn't bode well, so to speak, right? For the theory. So
that's true, Alex. I have here a question in the messages. So it's by an anonymous attendee. I'm still going to ask it. So, what is your perspective on the bear case against Bitcoin? That's oppressive governments do not like competition, and over time will crush Bitcoin by whatever means necessary: appropriation, prohibition, overregulation, taxation, etc. What do you think, Alex?
I think this is entirely possible, in actual fact. I mean, the fact that Bitcoin is decentralized and cannot be controlled by any single party, it's only partially true. You know, it's a much more nuanced situation that meets the eye. First and foremost, because as I was mentioning before, the mining actually is done in a highly centralized fashion. And to imagine that governments do not know where the mining occurs is just not realistic. For example, we all know that a lot of mining is done in Inner Mongolia and China, right? So towards the Mongolian and Russian border, etc. And then, you know, of course, a lot of it is also done where there is available hydroelectricity and things like that. But by the very nature of this mining is not decentralized, right? So it's done in a humongous, you know, hangars full of rigs. And so if governments were to sort of really go after that, they certainly have technical means of doing it, right? So whether they want to do it in, you know, full fury and glory remains to be seen. But taxation and things like that, it's actually desirable, because it would be wrong in some sense to have an...
I don't know.
Well, okay. Look, opinions, in my mind, all right. So I'm not speaking for both of us. I'm speaking for myself. I think that taxation is necessary. Yeah, I know that you all right, let's not go into that.
So,
but taxation is actually desirable to make it a reasonable asset class, you know, kind of more institutionalized and so on and so forth, because money, as I mentioned already, comes along with KYC to some degree, and AML, which certainly needs to be robustly implemented, and taxation. So all this is per se is not so bad, but you know, that what you know, whether let me put it this way, whether the government really wants to, you know, shut down Bitcoin remains to be seen. If they do want to do this, they do have technical means of doing it, perhaps not at the level of individual government, but at the level of, say, a group of governments. Let me leave it at that. Huh?
Alex, thank you very much for your time. I would like to remind to everybody that attended this discussion that the book that Alex and I co-authored is now available. You can pre-order it on most on the publisher, but you know, the link is available on the invites to our MetaCode Talks episode today. Alex, thank you again, and I hope that we have the occasion to follow up on this fascinating discussion.
Thank you, Adrian. It was a real pleasure, and I wish every success to MetaCode. It was a pleasure writing a book with you, and hopefully, if we manage to do this, we might be able to sell it for one of the cryptocurrencies. If we manage to you know, overcome technical hurdles, which are not insignificant, but it would be a good test case. Anyway, thank you, Adrian. Best of luck, and thanks everybody else. Goodbye.
Thank you.